This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. If you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast and please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to, well, just about anyone really. This week, I'm trying to understand why Theresa May is getting such a hard time from her own side in negotiating Brexit. And if you're interested in Brexit or just feel obliged to know about it for the sake of your children, then you might like another BBC podcast called Brexit Cast, which features some genuinely interesting new insights on Brexit.
Despite our best efforts, it was not possible to reach a complete agreement today.
We will reconvene before the end of the week, and I am also confident that we will conclude this positively.
We will not accept any form of regulatory divergence which separates Northern Ireland economically or politically from the rest of the UK.
Before my right honourable friend next goes to Brussels, will she apply a new coat of paint to her red lines? Because I fear on Monday they were beginning to look a little bit pink.
I am surprised and disappointed that the British government now appears not to be in a position to conclude what was agreed earlier today.
What an embarrassment.
Yeah. Yeah. Shambles.
What a week it's been. On Monday, a deal between Britain and the EU that would have allowed negotiations to proceed to a second stage was scuppered by a phone call between Theresa May and Arlene Foster, leader of Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party. Today, the government says it's close to an agreement, but there's more work to do to break the deadlock talks. But what this has proved is that even small groups within the UK can completely derail the government's plans for progress on Brexit. So today, I'm looking to get briefed on who is demanding what from the Brexit process and how much leverage they actually have. Step inside the briefing room and share Theresa May's Brexit problems. Of course, officially, the Prime Minister is negotiating with the European Union. So let's remind ourselves what the EU wants. Adam Fleming is the BBC's Brussels correspondent and is a presenter on the Brexit Cast podcast. So which groups in Europe does Theresa May need to think about?
Right, here we go. First of all, there's Task Force 50 of the European Commission. So they're the executive arm of the EU. They're the ones that are doing the technical negotiations, the real detailed technical work comparing this directive and that regulation. And of course, there the household name is Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator. Don't ignore his boss, the president of the Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. And don't ignore his chief of staff, Martin Selmayr, who likes to keep an eye on all the goings-on in the Commission. And so is a fairly influential person there. Now, they are following instructions, guidelines given to them by the 27 member states. And there, they say everyone is equal, but there are a few countries that are first among equals. Germany and France, for example, seem to have been quite instrumental earlier on this year when they decided that there wasn't going to be sufficient progress enough to move on to phase two. And of course, Ireland have what some people call a veto because the other 26 say they won't progress unless Ireland is happy about the issues relating to the border. Don't forget the European Parliament. They get a vote on the final deal and they will start considering it in October 2018. And then when we look further to the future, this final trade deal or future partnership, if that's judged to be something called a mixed agreement, which means it doesn't just affect EU law, but it has an impact in the individual member states, well, then the national parliaments of the member states will get to ratify that and have a vote on it too, including, remember, the Wallonian Parliament here in Belgium, who famously held up the trade deal with Canada.
Now, am I right in thinking that all these groups don't have a vision of the final outcome?
Very good question. One senior official put it to me, it's very hard for the EU to construct a new partnership based only on negatives. But we can boil it down to four big things that they say they will insist upon. The first one is this idea that not being a member cannot be as good as being a member. They say the only way you can get truly frictionless trade is by being in the EU. They also insist on their mantra of no cherry picking of the four freedoms, which means the free movement of people, capital, goods and services. All four come together. They're indivisible. Another thing they really care about that sounds quite technical is what they refer to as the internal legal order of the EU. What that means is they don't want anything from outside interfering with the internal decision-making processes that the 27 will continue to go through after the UK has left. So, for example, they do not want an external body that monitors citizens' rights being able to instruct the European Court of Justice how to interpret EU law. And the fourth thing I keep hearing is this concept of a level playing field. The EU does not want a big, powerful neighbour really close by that could potentially undercut the EU model.
Now, whoever they are, do you think that they believe currently that Theresa May can deliver on a deal?
There are conversations happening very frequently, privately, about how long Theresa May will remain Prime Minister, how stable her government is, and to what extent the EU should help her out. They are totally aware that Theresa May has to deliver the final Brexit deal and get it through the British Parliament. Otherwise, there is no deal at the end of this, and the EU wants to avoid that situation.
Adam Fleming. So that's Brussels. But as we're discovering, some of the biggest obstacles to the PM's deal-making are scattered around the British Isles. So let's start with what Wales wants. Nick Cervini is the BBC's Wales political editor.
From the Welsh Government's perspective, I would say it's a combination of big picture in relation to trade and then the more specific issues in relation to the devolved administrations. The red lines cover those two areas. So when you look at trade, the First Minister of Wales, Catherine Jones, effectively wants as soft a Brexit as possible. He wants to have full and unfettered access, as he calls it, to the single market. He wants to remain in the customs union. And a bit of history is important, I think. After the demise of heavy industry, a lot of international companies came to Wales off the back of successful inward investment programmes. There is a fear that if we come out of the EU, many of these huge employers would maybe struggle or have more of an uncertain future. I think certainly in relation to farming, there's an acknowledgement now that we're replacing one single market with another one. In other words, we're moving from the EU to a UK framework. And that's an acknowledgement that most of Welsh meat, for example, lamb and beef, will go to England. So there would have to be a replacement of the rules and regulations that we see at a pan-EU level now within the UK. In the early days after the Brexit vote, the message from the Welsh Government was, look, don't even touch agriculture. This is a devolved matter. This is ours. Now there's acknowledgement has to be done at a UK level. But what they really want is to have a realistic say and an influence in how all of these new policies are put together.
Nick Cervini. BBC Scotland editor Sarah Smith joined me in the briefing room earlier.
Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party, turned in a stunning performance at the snap general election earlier this year. She went from one MP in Scotland to 13, and that's largely as a result of her ebullient leadership and also because she campaigned very hard on the question of the union, that Scotland should stay part of the United Kingdom, and she attracted a lot of voters with that message. That means the 13 MPs that she has are very strongly committed to the United Kingdom and very much against anything that looks as though it might in any way peel off any part of the UK or create a different settlement for any of the constituent countries of the UK.
Now, Ruth Davidson herself is not in Parliament.
She's in the Scottish Parliament, but she is the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party and basically can whip those 13 MPs. She demonstrated this week that she has got 13 of them behind her, and that, of course, gives her more votes than the DUP have got. She's got 13 to their 10.
So to get this absolutely straight, those 13 Scottish MPs, despite the fact that she's not in the Westminster Parliament, will tend to follow what Ruth Davidson wants over Brexit.
They will, because she is the one who is taking the tempo of the Scottish electorate, the people who will return them to their seats. And if they were seen to be giving any ground on allowing any part of the United Kingdom to have some kind of different regime that looked as though the UK, the fabric of the UK, was under threat, they'd be punished by the voters as well as by Ruth Davidson.
Does she regard any deal that would give Northern Ireland a particular status to the rest of the United Kingdom as being a very big problem for her?
She does. She thinks that that would be unacceptable. That's partly an ideological position, that the UK should have all of the same rules and regulations if we are one United Kingdom. And it's also partly because the Scottish Nationalist Party would soon start to argue that the same deal should be given to Scotland, and she very much does not want to see Scotland peeling away from the UK in any way.
When it comes to other questions to do with Brexit further down the line, where does she stand on these questions?
Ruth Davidson campaigned to remain in the EU, and she's made no secret of her Remainer tendencies. If asked how she would vote if there was another referendum tomorrow, she still says that she would like to remain. And after the referendum, she talked frequently of wanting to remain in the single market, if that was possible, even as we left the European Union. So she doesn't have a problem with the idea of us being closely aligned with the rules and regulations of the EU. In fact, you might see that as a very attractive option. Her big problem comes if there are differences within the different constituent parts of the UK.
Now, that takes us, of course, to the Scottish National Party's stance. Can you explain that to us?
This time last year, the Scottish National Party published a pretty detailed paper, which they said explained how Scotland could stay in the single market and in the customs union whilst also remaining within the United Kingdom. They thought that Scotland could have a separate status that meant it stayed in something like the EEA. They were told by the UK government that was simply not practical. It was unworkable, they were told. And that plan has gone into abeyance. As soon as they see something similar being mooted for Northern Ireland, they, of course, immediately start to argue, well, if that's good enough for Northern Ireland, why is it not good enough for Scotland? They'll reiterate the argument that Scotland voted 62% to remain in the European Union, and whilst they accept that we are leaving the EU, they will continue to make these arguments about a closer alignment with the EU for Scotland than in the rest of the UK. That has been put to bed, the UK government thought, by telling the Scottish government that plan could never work. Of course, now they've revived that idea with the plans that we've seen for Northern Ireland.
Sarah Smith, so that was more complicated than you might have expected. But what about the main Westminster parties? Katie Balls is political correspondent for The Spectator magazine, and she took me through the fractured terrain of Brexit politics in the Commons, beginning with the Tory tribes.
So if you start at the most Brexit end of the spectrum, that you'll have the no-deal Brexiteers, and these are the people John Major would probably call the bastards. These are Tories who basically their whole life mission has been for Britain to leave the European Union, and they probably put that mission above party. They are people who would probably say they're interested in a deal with Brussels, but if you looked at their red lines, it'd be very hard to see how that deal could come about, because they will not compromise in any way on things like the ECJ.
The European Court of Justice.
And money, things like trade. They want a very clean Brexit, and they're not willing to budge here and there. It's your Bernard Jenkins, your Peter Bone, Jacob Rees-Mogg, that kind of ilk.
How many of them are there?
I think if you're going on the most hardline end, you're probably 20 maximum. But the problem is, it is a group that are very good at getting their voice heard. And they're also good at getting other people to join their cause. So they're a dangerous group in the sense that they might smell a rat early on, but they might then manage to convince more Eurosceptic MPs that they're right. So it's a number that can grow, and also grow depending on how many concessions the government makes. Which probably takes us to our next group of MPs, the Eurosceptics, but perhaps the slightly more pragmatic ones. And you could call them the Vote Leave Brexiteers. So these are people who campaigned for Britain to leave the EU. They are a bit more pragmatic. So long as Britain does leave the EU and it does leave the single market and the customs union, they can take a few compromises here and there. They can deal with a, you know, £45 billion, £50 billion Brexit bill, so long as the end product is a proper Brexit. So that group is basically people like Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Ian Duncan Smith.
And then where are the other Conservatives?
Well, you have the quite sizable group, which is the Stop Banging On About Europe group. And these are people who probably supported David Cameron, and as a result, they might have backed Remain in the EU referendum. But ultimately, they're not ideologically opposed to the EU, they're not ideologically attached to it, they just want whatever works. And ideally, they'd quite like to get some domestic agenda through, maybe focus on something other than Europe, as David Cameron once wanted to do, but didn't quite work out for him. And this is quite a big group. This is people like Grant Shapps, Liz Truss, Nick Bowles. They want what works, and that would be Brexit, if it works, and leaving the single market and the customs union. But probably if things start to look like it was not working out like that, they would say, why not join the EEA or, you know, do the Norway-type model? Which then takes us to the mutineers, which is probably the loudest at the moment group in the Conservative Party on Brexit.
Really?
So this is your Anna Soubrys, your Nicky Morgans, your Dominic Greaves. And these are the people recently described in the Telegraph as the Brexit mutineers who want to, you know, stop Brexit. They say they respect the result, but they want the softest Brexit possible.
Is there any eventual settlement that the No Deal 20 could come to which the Deal 20 could cope with?
I don't think so.
OK, so these are irreconcilable. So Theresa May has to deal with the fact that she actually has some irreconcilables in her party. Now, of course, she doesn't have a majority, so let's look at the other parties now.
Liberal Democrats are probably the rejoiners. They just want to rejoin. And there are a few strays from the other parties that are probably with them. But in general, when you look to Labour, they're a lot more nuanced in what they're saying. You do have probably their version of the hardline no-deal Brexiteers. They think the only way you can really reimagine the economy, reset the dial and create the socialist Britain is to leave the EU.
OK, and then the broad section of the Labour Party.
So then you have the kind of the Labour single market group, which are quite close with the Tory mutineers. They have a similar aim. This group say they recognise the result, but they want it to be as close a relationship as possible. They want to hug the EU.
OK, so which group does she have to worry most about, do you think?
So on a day-to-day basis, she needs to worry about the soft Brexiteers in her party, so the mutineers, as they have been called, because this is a group that has the potential to join up with Labour and tip the balance on votes to try and get the softer Brexit.
So the perception that the hard Brexiteers are May's biggest problem is actually wrong. It's the mutineers.
No, I think the hard Brexiteers are her biggest problem, but day-to-day, it's the mutineers. And the reason for this is the mutineer group realise that at the moment, the deal on the table when you get to the end of this is to vote. So you take what's on the table, so the deal the government have come up with, or you take no deal at all. Now, if you want a closer relationship with Europe, there's no way you're going to really vote for the no deal option, which is, you know, crashing out, in theory, a cliff edge Brexit. So they're doing everything they can while they have parliamentary powers to try and change what the government is doing. The hardline Brexiteers don't have such an urgency, because when they do get to that vote, they know they have the power here to say, well, we're actually going to go with no deal.
Katie Balls. But what has led to claims of a Brexit crisis in the last 2 weeks has been the problem of the border between EU remaining Ireland and EU leaving Northern Ireland. The BBC's Northern Ireland editor, Mark Devenport, joins me live now in the briefing room to explain the pressures and red lines on the island of Ireland. And Mark, in the last hour, we've had the Commission spokesperson saying things are going to continue right the way through the night. Stay tuned. Something might happen by tomorrow morning. Where is the DUP standing as we go into the night?
Well, it sounds like some of the stormont negotiations that have happened down through the years that always tend to go right up to the deadline and then beyond it. The Democratic Unionists are our biggest party here, and they supported Brexit. So they went together with their current allies, the Conservatives, in favour of Brexit, even though the referendum result in Northern Ireland actually was in favour of Remain. It was 56% in favour of Remain and 44% for Leave. But the Democratic Unionists find themselves in a pivotal position because they are effectively the only representatives of Northern Ireland in the House of Commons at the moment. And because of the very close result in the snap election, they are propping up Theresa May in power with their 10 votes. And so they have a very potent position in relation to all of this. And so one of the reasons why we are in the situation that we're in is that they weren't properly sounded out about that deal that Mrs. May wanted to cut with the European Union at the start of the week. And they were able to bring the whole process to a shuddering halt.
OK, so what do they actually want? What are their red lines and why are they so hard on this?
Well, as the name implies, their governing principle is the union, preserving the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain and resisting any move towards a united Ireland. And they would resist that, whether that was through force during the Troubles with the IRA campaign, or as they would see it, through subterfuge, an attempt to slowly but surely get a greater say for Dublin in the affairs of Northern Ireland. And this goes back many decades. Back in the mid-1980s, they were resisting the Anglo-Irish Agreement. That was when they ran an Ulster Says No campaign. And there are some similarities now to their reaction to what's going on. They have, over time, become converted to practical cooperation in a number of areas. Their ministers, when they were in government, attended meetings together with their southern counterparts. But they did not like what they saw, which was an Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, negotiating for, as they saw it, a harmonisation of policies across the Irish border, north and south, which might, over the course of time, drive a wedge between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom, building up both political and trade barriers.
So they're worried about a situation where somewhere down the line somebody says, well, you know, you've got closer to Ireland in this way than you are to the UK, you might as well be part of the same thing. Is that the scenario they've got in their heads?
Yes, because it's a moving situation in Northern Ireland. It's affected by demographic changes as the Catholic population grows and things become tighter in the course of public opinions about possible future border polls. And I think within that scenario, they want to ensure that nothing happens so that de facto, over time, Northern Ireland becomes more Irish. So they have been persuaded to diverge from the UK in relation to a couple of practical areas, but this was a bit of a bridge too far for them.
Now, the Irish government itself, what's the Irish government's ideal scenario and what's its red lines?
Well, the Irish government would like to preserve the ease of movement of people and of goods across the border that happens right now. They don't want to see any kind of a hard border there. They share that to some extent with London, but they particularly would like to see, really, I think, ultimately, the UK staying in the customs union and the single market, because that will make things much easier for them, not only in terms of north-south trade, but in terms of trade across the Irish Sea between the Irish Republic and Great Britain, which is extremely important to them. So they made no secret of the fact that they were opposed to Brexit. Then when it happened, they wanted the UK to stay in the customs union. And now, more recently, they have settled, because Theresa May has said that wasn't an option, for pushing what they term no regulatory divergence, or regulatory alignment, it was then taken down to, which is basically trying to keep trade rules as similar as possible in order to do away with the need for too many checks on that border which divides Ireland.
Thanks very much, Mark. And now, to help me draw all that together, is BBC Reality Check correspondent and presenter of Brexit, A Guide for the Perplexed, Chris Morris. This week has obviously been particularly difficult for the government. Is there anything new we've learned from it?
I'll tell you what I think's happened, David. And, you know, there have been all sorts of descriptions of the Brexit negotiations. We've had clocks ticking, magical thinking, bluff and bluster, disguising a lot of hard technical work, actually, behind the scenes. But this was the week when the negotiations, particularly on the British side, were given a pretty bracing dose of political reality, because the whole purpose in phase one of the talks on the withdrawal issues, if you like the financial settlement, the divorce bill, has been to reach this benchmark of sufficient progress set by the EU, which is about as vague a term as you can get. The really tough stuff, the outlines of a future relationship, a long-term relationship between the UK and the EU, was supposed to be reserved for the second phase of the talks. But when it comes to the border in Ireland, well, that's absolutely bound up with the future, which is, to be fair, what the government's been saying from the start. But what's happened this week is that the big unresolved argument about Brexit, what on earth does it actually mean, has come tumbling out into the open. We've had the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, confirming that the Cabinet still hasn't had its big debate about the end state of Brexit, the kind of trading relationship we want. But the Irish border, I think, has now become a proxy for that debate. And basically, on one side, there are those who think the UK, including Northern Ireland, should be as closely aligned with the EU as possible in order to keep as much of the trading relationship as possible the same it is at the moment. And on the other side are those who argue that one of the main reasons for voting to leave the EU was so that we don't have to be the same. We can set out on our own, and that too much regulatory alignment, as we've been hearing this week, will simply hold us back.
OK, so in a way, what we've got is a harbinger of things to come. Let's stick with what we've got at the moment. I mean, given what we've heard about competing demands over Ireland, how likely is it, do you think, that they will actually be able to find some kind of agreement before the summit next week?
I certainly wouldn't rule an agreement out. There's lots going on behind the scenes, and I've been covering the EU for long enough to know that it's usually when stalemate seems to be the order of the day that some kind of text, some kind of compromise emerges. The trouble is the stakes are so high. We're basically talking about the way the UK is going to reorganise its future relationship with all its nearest neighbours in record time. And the careful choreography of a deal on sufficient progress was certainly blown out of the water last Monday by the intervention of the DUP. But as you've been hearing throughout the programme, wherever Theresa May turns, she encounters people with equally strong views that simply don't all stitch together. So I think the EU and the UK and Ireland and the DUP may well find a form of words to get them through the next week. But make no mistake, sooner or later, a crunch is coming that will leave somebody extremely upset.
Now, leaving aside, if you like, the long-term future crunches, talking about this first phase, there, you said there'll be more discussions about Ireland. You'll probably get there. There's going to be the divorce bill still slightly kind of going on about citizens' rights in the future and so on. Are we nearly at the end of that phase one?
We are, I think. But the thing about sufficient progress, even if it is declared and we move on to start talking about a transition period and the outlines of a future relationship on trade and security and so on, there is still work to be done on those divorce issues, Ireland, divorce bill, citizens' rights. I mean, take the financial settlement, for example. It seems there's now agreement on the type of financial commitments the UK acknowledges it has partial responsibility for. But the exact size of the UK share of that total, well, it depends on which years you use to calculate a figure. It depends on changing exchange rates. It depends on changing interest rates. It depends on how many financial commitments you think may never actually get paid out in the future. So there's a huge amount of technical work still to do. And the same on the Irish border. If you can sort out a free trade agreement in the future, many of the problems on that border would fade away. But it's about single market regulations, it's about customs duties, it's about an acutely sensitive political balance, which has been dealt with really for the last 20 years under the umbrella of joint membership of the EU since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement. When Brexit happens, a lot of that will change.
So we certainly can't heave a sigh of relief at the end of next week, let's say, if we've dealt with the Irish question. What has all this told you about the future of the negotiations, the long-term future?
I think it tells us how incredibly difficult they're going to be. It's not just a rhetorical flourish when people say these are the most challenging negotiations the UK has faced in its modern history. I mean, let me give you just one example. Boris Johnson said earlier today that what we want, big picture, is a deep and special partnership with the EU in which we intensify our trading relationship. But you can't really intensify what we've already got. It doesn't get any deeper anywhere in the world than the single market and the customs union. Now, you can obviously argue that for reasons of sovereignty, economic links will be less intense, but you can't really argue for greater sovereignty and greater integration at the same time. And that's why the trade deal the UK will be trying to forge in the future will be pretty much unique in the history of trade negotiations, because there's never really been a trade deal before where the two parties are trying to get further apart rather than the two parties trying to get closer together.
Chris Morris, thanks. My thanks also to Mark Devenport, Sarah Smith, Adam Fleming, Nick Cervini and Katie Balls. We'll be back next week, hopefully, with something less complicated, like the Middle East peace process or quantum gravity or something like that. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider.